The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
My next guest has sold more than 25 million copies of his books. That's the copies that he sold in the English language. I think you can add another 15 or 20 million on top of that for the other 45 languages in which they have been printed. He is the author of the number one ladies detective agency, as well as just a phenomenal amount of other books. I mean, I think if he only published one copy of each book, he'd still be nudging the 20 million mark, given how prolific he is. Though he started his career as a professor of medical law, he is Sir Alexander McCall-Smith. Alexander, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Am I all right to call you Alexander, or does one require calling you Sir Alexander?
No, call me Sandy. Sandy is a shortened version of Alexander, fewer syllables, and that's the name that I usually respond to when people talk to me.
Oh, great. This will increase our efficiency no end. Can I talk to you about your sheer quantity of output? Because it is as impressive as it is horrifying. How do you do it?
Well, I must say I'm very fortunate in that I enjoy what I'm doing. And I think that makes a big difference. If you like what you're doing, then it doesn't become a task. It's hardly work, so to speak. I like writing. I love writing, and I write every day. And that means that if you write every day, you can get through quite a lot. So I do usually do 5 books a year, which is breaking all known rules of publishing. But you know, they shake their finger at you and say one book a year, but not every year. But I just feel that I like to do it that way. I'm a serial novelist. I have series of books. That's a sort of odd thing. It's a condition, really. It gets hold of you and you write these series. No known cure for serial novelism. You just write these books and then you die. So that's what I do.
I am no mathematician, but a rough tot means that means you are producing a book about every 9 weeks.
I haven't done the maths, but that could be right. I mean, I sometimes write 2 books at the same time, in that they overlap a bit. If at all possible, I like to finish one and then move on to the next. But sometimes the program slips a bit and I find myself writing 2 books, which I don't mind, as long as I remember which book I'm writing. I once actually got them slightly mixed up, and my editor in New York got in touch with me and he said, oh, on page 45 or whatever it was, one of the characters is talking like a character from one of the other series. And I had a look at it and he was absolutely right. And I'd slipped between fictional worlds. But generally speaking, I try not to do that.
And how much of it is rooted in pre-existing knowledge, and how much research do you have to do? Because you had a very interesting discussion of Neanderthal grammar in one of your recent books. And it doesn't strike me as the kind of thing one comes pre-equipped with. Did you have to study up?
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of what I write is based on life experience, so to speak. And I think that's probably the case with most writers, that you go through life, you meet people, you encounter all sorts of situations, and then that's reflected.
Neanderthals?
In the book. Well, Neanderthals. Now, Neanderthals are interesting. Thank you for mentioning Neanderthals. they don't crop up every day. But this is in my recent book, The Lost Language of Oysters. There's somebody there. It's a poking fun at, I suppose, at professors of linguistics. There's this character who's studying Neanderthal grammar. Now, we actually don't know anything about how the Neanderthals communicated. There is a bit of discussion. I've seen academic discussion about how extensive their vocabulary would have been, whether they would have had sophisticated language. It's all speculation. And this particular scholar in this book, he's an Italian professor of linguistics, has written a learned paper on the Neanderthal language, and he postulates that it's almost certain that the Neanderthal word for mother had an M sound to it. But that's just all a bit of a jeu d'esprit. It's all ridiculous.
I like the fact as well that he has the intellectual scope to do this, thanks to his department being overfunded by a multiple of 10, thanks to the misplacement of a decimal point.
There was a decimal point error back in the 1970s in this German university. And as a result of that, they get 10 times more money than they are meant to. And of course, This is something that happens with academics. Having been an academic myself in the past, if people give you money, if the university gives you money and then proposes to take it away, my goodness, you put up a fight, very, very big fight, and you say the skies are falling. There's a direct attack on freedom of thought and all of those arguments in order to keep your funding. So they have this 10 times more money than they were entitled to. And it became political. And I say that in this particular case, the Bader-Meinhof gang got in on the act and threatened to blow up the university if the money was taken away. So you get the general tenor of it. It's not exactly social realism.
Well, on the general tenor, this is a thing that I'm intrigued by. How, if you had the lofty positions that you have held, being a professor of things like ethics and medical law, in doing so, I would have thought the kind of works that you would produce would be significant leather-bound tomes about legal matters rather than accessible, fun novels. Were you pressured to do the former rather than the latter? Did you find yourself being looked down on for being read by millions?
Well, yes. I mean, there's a certain sort of sniffiness in the literary world. If your books are read by a lot of people, in some circles, the view is taken that they can't be of any significance, that the really worthy things, according to that view of the world, are those things that are read by just a handful of people. And therefore, the more unreadable a novel is, the greater its literary merit. Now, that's absolute nonsense, of course. But there are some people who hold that view, and they look down on people whose books are widely read. It's a form of snobbery. Snobbery is a feature of human society. You know, put a number of people in a room and some people behave in a snobbish fashion. So there is that literary snobbery does exist. In my particular case, I used to write. I wrote academic works, and then I started to write short stories. I wrote a lot of children's books. I did over 40 children's books, and I very much enjoyed that, and then became a full-time novelist eventually. I think it's compatible. I think that you can make serious points about the world in such a way that they're readable. You can use humour to talk about the tragedy of the world. I mean, the world is in one sense a veil of tears, and you can say important things about that, but in a way that entertains people and which people may even find amusing.
And of course, the point that you've made publicly before, but is a very interesting one, that your background in law gives you a very wide experience and insight into that veil of tears, because you would have seen the worst of humanity coming across your desk in various different legal cases.
Well, that's right. I mean, the law is a very, very broad discipline. All sorts of law deals with all sorts of human problems. Various branches of it deal with psychological problems and emotional problems that people have. So yes, it's a good preparation for, I suppose, exploring the world and understanding the world and looking at human relationships. So the law isn't the dry, dusty thing that some people imagine it might be. That there are corners of it, which of course are very dry and dusty, but a lot of it is most of it is concerned with a raw human experience. And I suppose being trained as a lawyer, you're trained to look at the human situation and analyze it and see what's going on. So being a lawyer is perfectly compatible with being a novelist. Walter Scott, for example, was a lawyer, and he of course invented the historical novel, and his novels have very considerable scope. So I don't think that lawyers need to be ashamed of their calling when they can look at it in the light of literary endeavour.
Particularly when the practice gives you plot devices like feeding people to crocodiles mid baptism.
Well, that occurs in the first number one ladies detective agency book. And that was, I got that idea from an actual case. I was writing a book on the criminal law of Botswana with a colleague there in Botswana, and we were looking through these case reports, which had never really been published, but they were the original court documents. And we came across a case where a reverend got his flock to come along for a mass baptism in the Limpopo River. And so the sinners, as they then were before they were immersed in the water, they came to the side of the bank, and the reverend went in with six sinners into the water, but only five sinners emerged. And that, you know, it's a really sad situation, but that did happen.
One have to hope that the original sin was cleansed pre-consumption.
I would have. I think we can conclude that. I think we must conclude that. That's there's no happy ending to that story, but that relieves it a bit of the tragedy that the poor chap had been washed clean before the crocodile got him.
Sandy, it has been a great pleasure to talk to you. That is Sir Alexander McCall Smith. The latest book, highly entertaining, The Lost Language of Oysters, is available now.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.